So we're going to start with a public hearing on House Bill 2811. Representative Shetterly, I know you have to be in another meeting, so.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Lane Shetterly, State Representative, District 23, and I'll be very brief on this bill. House Bill 2811 and its companion bill, House Bill 3339, come to you through the joint efforts of a number of groups, including the Oregon Veterinary Association, the Oregon Cattlemen's Association. Glenn Stonebrink is here from the Cattlemen's Association, the Oregon Hay and Forage Association, the Humane Society. And 2811 in particular just clarifies the minimum care statute, or S-167.310, relating to livestock animals that are what we call non-ambulatory, that is unable to stand or walk without assistance. And it says that in that case, the care provider would provide either humane euthanasia or immediate and ongoing care to restore the animal to an ambulatory state. It's not a revolutionary change in the statute. I think it just clarifies what the obligation of the person in charge of the animal's care's obligation is. And again, I want to commend the work group that helped with the language on this. There was some negotiation that resulted in the language that you have. We have very much of a consensus bill among both the Humane Society and the industry and other folks interested in this, and so I would commend it to you.
All right. Thank you very much, Representative Shetterly.
Thank you.
I'm going to close the public hearing on 2811 and open the public hearing on Senate Bill 894. Senator Deckard, I know that you and Senator Deckard, you and Representative Shetterly have to be in a meeting, I understand. So,
yeah. You've opened the hearing.
We did. Just to be official. There you go.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Ryan Deckert, State Senator from District 14, I believe is my new number. Mr. Chair, thank you, first of all, for hearing Senate Bill 894. It is a priority bill of mine, and it really comes to you. Mr. Harvey, who is the president of the Parents Association at Conestoga Middle School in Beaverton, really will tell you the story of where this bill came from. But we had a really unfortunate incident in our community in Beaverton. It received a lot of media attention, where we had one of our teachers had a really regrettable relationship with a student. It was a felony, and the teacher is now being charged with it and awaiting trial. Mr. Harvey and a number of parents approached my office about what we could do in terms of preventing future situations like this from a statewide perspective, and also ensuring that taxpayers don't pick up the fines that will be paid after this situation is adjudicated. We worked for a long time, and that's why this bill is a priority bill, because you simply cannot, under state law, nor do I know that it would be appropriate to simply take someone's pension funds. Working with a number of groups, and certainly Dave Hendricks in Legislative Council, who was really busy with the PERS committee, this is the solution that we came up with, which is before you in the form of Senate Bill 894. It simply provides that if a teacher in the line of duty or a public employee in the line of duty is convicted of a felony, that the judge, if he or she chooses, can use those pension funds to pay the fine. So it can dip into that pension fund account to pay the fine in these really rare and really extreme unfortunate circumstances where you would have one of these regrettable situations occur. That is the essence of the bill. I'll turn it over to Mr. Harvey, who is the president of the Conestoga Middle School Parents Association.
All right, great. Thank you, Senator. Any questions of Senator Deckard while he's in our presence?
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Brady.
What about cases where, for example, a public employee, there was a case recently where a human services employee didn't adequately supervise a child, and the child ended up getting killed, and I don't know where that case is in the process, but what about cases like that where somebody doesn't do their duties and is accused of not doing their duties and it's adjudicated in the course of things? How would that How would this bill affect that?
Well, the two things, Chairman and Senator Burdick, the two things that would need to occur for this bill to kick in, and that's why I think it was really narrowly drafted in a manner that really gets at the heart of these situations, which are extreme and rare, is that you would have to have a conviction of a felony in the line of duty. And I don't know if that reaches, the case that you were citing, reaches that felony in the line of duty plateau. But if it does, then you would have to have the judge decide they've levied the fines, you've had a conviction, the fines have been levied, and the judge would then have to decide, yes, we will use part of the pension funds to actually remunerate the fines that were levied. So I think the bill you have before you, a lot of work went into it to get those really tight circumstances, like the one that we had at Conestoga Middle School in Beaverton. I'm not sure that one would fit, because you'd have to reach those two hurdles to have it kick in. But in that, if it did, then I'm comfortable. If you have a felony conviction, then I know that I'm comfortable with the usage of the retirement funds to pay back the fines.
And Mr. Chairman, yes. maybe this is a question for counsel, but these felony fines, which you really don't hear much about, we're talking about jail time usually with felonies as an issue, but the fines that are levied, do any of those get to the victim? I know they get some sort of victim compensation fund, as I believe, but is there any provision for the victim?
Mr. Chairman, as a committee, there are fines and there's restitution too, so it all depends what the court order is.
So, Mr. Chairman, this would apply only to fines and not to restitution?
Well, if they were, Mr. Chair, Senator Burdick, Vice Chair Burdick, my understanding is that, no, the restitution would be part of the fines, and that would be applicable under this, which I think is entirely appropriate in these. Really, I think the circumstance you're going to hear about is a good example of one that is entirely appropriate for that circumstance to kick in.
Yeah, I think, you know, the terminology in the bill is monetary obligation, which I would assume takes into account both fines and restitution. And I think the committee will remember we had a bill earlier in the session that we passed out that would require that judges impose restitution in all cases, which currently they were not obligated to do. I don't know what the status of that bill is in the House, but I assume it will wander its way through the process. So, any other questions for Senator Decker? None? Senator Decker, thank you very much for gracing us with your presence and committee.
Thank you.
Appreciate it, and we'll go ahead and take testimony then from Mr. Harvey.
Thank you.
Good morning, Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Wayne Harvey. I live at 13175 Southwest Cavalier Court in Beaverton, Oregon. I am the current president, 2002 to 2003, Conestoga Middle School, Beaverton's parent organization, which is their sort of their PTO. We refer to it as the Conestoga CCO. And as you may have heard, back in December of last year, we had a case where a teacher was arrested at our school for multiple felony sexual assault charges against a student of the school. Not a student of this current school year, but of the last year. And needless to say, we had an uprising of the parents of the school, because some of these acts actually occurred in the school building, on school grounds, and in the classroom, and in storage rooms, and so forth. We had a lot of parents that were upset that the crime occurred, and looked to the school and the school district for answers as to how we can prevent things like this in the future. And through these series of dialogues with this Beaverton School District representatives and the folks that ran the school themselves, we quickly learned that even if the accused is found guilty and convicted of these crimes and sentenced to a prison term, that since he formally retired several days prior to his arrest, that while sitting in a prison cell, he will receive his retirement pension from the state purse. The parents felt this was inappropriate and sort of obscene, so we contacted Senator Deckard's office, and we want to thank the senator and his staff for the efforts that they have put forward thus far, and with the bill that we have. we realize that it won't have bearing, or possibly won't have bearing on this particular criminal case and so forth, but we hope that in the future it will allow the courts the ability to recoup some of the monies that the justice system spends and so forth. And as Senator Burdick mentioned, if some of that can go back to the victims, that would be great. We're not really familiar with that and how that would apply. But again, we just felt that it was, if in fact this accused individual is found guilty and indeed convicted of these crimes, that it was inappropriate that they would be able to get all that money, because we felt that if they were in the public's service of taking care of their children, that they violated that trust, especially because the crimes occurred in a school, in a schoolroom and so forth.
All right. Great. We have a number of questions. Mr. Delaney's here from PERS. We'll bring him up to chat about it. Ted, Senator Farrell just sent me a note here. I think it's a good question. Is what about a spouse or dependent who might need those retirement or pension benefits to support themselves? I don't assume that you're wanting to attach the entire amount, or assume the judge would take into consideration other persons that need to be supported. I assume. Senator Farrell, you can ask the question yourself if you want.
Mr. Chairman, you've captured the question. The question I have is, most of the time, or at least a part of the time, I assume that the retirement is looked on as a family asset, and that you may have spouse or other dependent children that have needs, including the replacement of the breadwinner, even though that happens to be a felon. And I assume these kind of cases only happen where we've got a state employee in the PERS system who previously had appeared to the community to be a pretty reliable person, because they would have passed background checks and be working for a state agency. So the spouse may have no knowledge of this activity, or kids. I mean, what happens to them if they're, you know, if they're dependent on this income? I mean, I support the bill. I think it's a great idea. I can't imagine anything more ridiculous than a felon sitting in the prison cell getting, you know, a PERS retirement. But what do you do with the family? Mm-hmm.
Senator, if I could add one more thing. One of the reasons that helped me bring this issue to Senator Deckert's attention to begin with is I'm retired from the United States Army. And after spending 20 years in the Army, and what I did in the Army was administration, and so the Department of Defense, and I believe the rule is in a lot of the government agencies, that you can retire, as you know, after 20 years of active service. I've seen half a dozen folks over my career that served up to 19 years of service and were just this shy of reaching that retirement goal. They committed a crime, and they were put on the street with $0. And if the United States federal government can do that, that's what brought it, you know, I don't feel that retirement is a guaranteed earned thing. I think that the individual has an obligation to you know, in a public service, to take care of those children. And even if it was the last week before retirement, I don't see the taxpayers owing him that. And I do feel bad, again, for the spouse and for the dependents and so forth. But
all right. Thank you. Mr. Delaney, you've now positioned yourself at the desk here. You want to talk. And you may be able to answer some of these questions, too, I assume, with spouses, maybe not. I don't know.
Members of the committee, for the record, Steve Delaney, PERS legislative liaison. As far as the spouse, no, the current language doesn't give any exemptions, so we would be looking at the benefit, whatever option the member had chosen, which could include survivorship options, would be the benefit we'd be looking at. That is one question that we haven't had time to research, but just wanted to go on the record with the committee, was this definition of benefits is found on line 24 of the bill. It says that this act applies only to benefits accrued. We have the question as to whether that's to be the monthly retirement benefit a member is going to be eventually eligible for, or would it also apply to the account balance? An individual could choose to get around this by withdrawing their account balance in cash as opposed to taking a monthly benefit. We just wanted to pose that question and have the committee go on record as to what the intent may be.
All right. We had a question raised by counsel late before the committee with respect to federal law and whether there may be restrictions in attaching pension benefits. I don't know whether you might have any insights.
Unfortunately, I do not work in that section, so I'm sorry. We do have staff that are aware of these issues, and I could bring a report back to committee very quickly, but I am not the expert on that issue.
If you would do me a favor and work with Mr. Taylor on these issues, I think you're right. We do need to discern which benefits and how that's constructed, and also the federal tax issues and whether we can attach these benefits or not, and then also I think the spouse benefits and such, we ought to talk about how maybe to protect those interests of spouses if we can.
Be happy to.
Right. Thank you. Any other questions for Mr. Delaney from the ERS?
Well, Mr. Chair,
you're sounding better today, by the way.
I'm getting better. My hearing is bad today, though. Thank you. I see the miracles of modern medicine and herbal teas. But my question is, your question to Mr. Delaney to research whether we can do this in the private sector?
No, the question is whether or not there are federal tax law restrictions in attaching the pension benefits, because there are certain nuances in federal law.
Right.
It's a minefield from what I can tell.
Well, my question would be, if you're going after federal or if you're going after public employees' pensions, I don't know if you can do that to private employees' pensions. And I have serious concerns about this. And Senator Farioli hit him right on the head, because I'm self-employed, and all my pension is through my husband's employer. We put a lot of money into his 401k, which is nothing now, but that's where all my money is. And I'll be darned if I'm going to have someone take that away from me because my husband has done something wrong, if that ever came up. I mean, that's really a serious issue, a very serious issue, and we're going to have to get past that.
All right. We'll let you fight that out with Senator Deckard and the Democratic Caucus. I'd like to get tickets, by the way. Senator Burdick?
The other issue that I'd want considered as you're looking at this is, you know, if there have been restitution commitments, you know, ordered by the judge, or fines for a felony, what is the process now? I mean, if they're getting a retirement benefit at that time, then that's income. So, you know, theoretically, they should owe those fines anyway if they're able to pay. So if there's another way of getting those fines paid, short of raiding a pension fund, which I have, you know, that raises alarms with me as well, that maybe, you know, we could take a look at the situation and see if it could be accomplished in a way that would not jeopardize the sanctity of those pension funds.
And didn't we do something with the, wasn't there a Portland police officer who was serving time?
But Mr. Chairman, that was for this case that the chairman's referring to was in Portland, where a police officer was on disability and was getting disability payments
from
the pension fund while he was in prison on a felony. And so that was a different situation with disability payments than it was with retirement.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Farioli.
Just to clarify the concern, I would hope that there'd be some sort of an adjudication process where the folks from the who were victimized by this would have an ability to come make a case demonstrating that the felon, that the convict, the perpetrator should have no benefit from their public employment because they violated the public trust. But I'd be very interested to see that you don't create more victims. You know, the kids were victimized, the parents were victimized in the case in Beaverton, and that deserves to be addressed. The perpetrator should not benefit from the violation of their public trust. That is a real clear connection for me. But if there are other innocents in this process that have no part in this thing, they should be protected in some way. So if you could figure out a way that the the earned benefit did not inure to the benefit of the perpetrator, but that others are protected, that I think would be the ideal solution. I support the concept of this bill. Just, it's in the application that I have a concern.
All right. Mr. Delaney, thank you for bringing these issues to us. Mary Botkin, you wanted to chat with us?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Mary Botkin with the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. I hate when I feel like I'm defending the rights of pedophiles. But you have already discussed all the issues that we're concerned about. It's not that the victims don't have some restitution process that they should and must have available to them. It is the application of how we get there. And, you know, with PERS, you don't have an account balance, quote unquote, until you retire. Mm-hmm. And so if you're eligible for retirement and you're going to get a monthly benefit, then I think the victims absolutely have a right to a piece of that in restitution. But as we did with the divorce decrees, I think that you have to have some kind of a legal document that says this is what is required, this is what is owed, this is your responsibility, and you get it upon retirement of the member. Because I'm concerned that if you try to take money out of the account prior to that, you really do end up with a situation where you may jeopardize the entire fund's tax status. And I don't, you know, and if you take out money early, then you lose better than half the account. And so I just think that there are some applicability issues here. And, you know, we certainly are not interested in protecting convicted felons and their responsibility for paying restitution to their victims. But in the same sense, we've got to be sure that their family is not further victimized by inappropriate behavior. And I don't, you know, I don't care what the felony charge is. If you're, you know, if you have a restitution issue, you ought to pay it. And we just need to figure out structurally how we do that so that we don't jeopardize the tax status of the fund, or that we don't establish a precedent that is not really, that we can't easily administer and just further frustrate victims by thinking that they're going to get something that they won't get for 30 years. You know, that just tends to make everybody angrier. So, having said that, we just want to be sure that they've been convicted, that they're, and that there's some kind of an order from the court so that PERS is not kind of unilaterally going in and taking the money out of somebody's account without due process.
Yeah. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr.
I think counsel is telling me we have some serious concerns about how this interplays with federal tax law. We're going to have some more research.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Issue.
Thank you very much. Other questions? Anyone else wishing to testify on Senate Bill 894?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator Brick. I think just for a witness who came here from Beaverton, and I'm still learning about the PERS system, but, you know, we all hear about the accounts and how the accounts build up, but for all practical purposes, those accounts, as Ms. Botkin said, really don't exist until retirement. So you had a person who was 35 years old when they committed a crime, and then you tried to get into that, quote, account. It really doesn't exist. So it's just, you know, that's the frustrating thing about this business is, you know, you see a situation like that, it just makes you crazy. You just want to climb the walls. And then you get down to the details of trying to figure out how to deal with it. And sometimes it's just not as simple as it looks like. So that would be my observation. I just think, you know, with the PERS retirement system, it is a good retirement system. I expect it to still be good after we do the reforms around here. And that person, that particular person who has retired, can well be held account. Mm-hmm. Held to account to pay off the fines that are owed from the monthly benefit.
All right, great. Very timely. Appreciate it. We're going to close the public hearing. We'll get some additional research done and maybe some amendments drafted that perhaps would satisfy the committee. Mr. Delaney, if you would work with Bill Taylor, I would appreciate that. And I think Senator Rick Deckard's staff to coordinate. All right. Senator Morissette, you've graced us with your presence. You have a bill, I believe it's Senate Bill 895. We'll open a public hearing on that bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Senator Bill Morissette, Senate District 6. This bill has been kicked around and was expected to have a hearing on the House side early on, and for some reason it fell through the cracks, and so I did introduce this as a priority bill. Representative Butler has worked on this. And I think it's an important bill because the data shows that, for instance, alcohol continues to be the drug of choice for a lot of youth. And 24% of 11th graders and 26% of the 8th graders reported drinking shortly before the survey was taken. It is a major contributing factor to the leading causes of death: automobile crashes, suicides, homicides, drowning. And it's interesting because as a teacher in Springfield for years, we always dreaded graduation day because we had several terrible accidents and deaths related to the all-night parties and graduation, and kids would be drinking and oftentimes have accidents, not always fatal, but that was an occurrence that happened too often. And the data also shows that children who do drink at an early age continue drinking, and I think part of this is cultural. And when I grew up in Montana, I had a friend whose family made wine, and every time I would walk into their house, they would hand me this big glass of wine. Now, times have changed. There is a greater consciousness about the issue of drinking, the consequences of family disruption, abuse, jail, all of these things related to, many of these things related to alcohol abuse. And alcohol by itself is recognized as one of the drugs of choice that adult Americans use, and so it's not that this is an anti-alcohol bill, but it does make the consequences of providing alcohol to a minor more stringent, and I think that is one of the sources that we have to try to shut off. People buying alcohol without thinking twice about the consequences. Now, if a minor is injured or killed while using alcohol bought by an adult, the adult will be held responsible. The penalties go up, but still it's a discretion of the judge. The judge does not have to sentence, impose a maximum sentence of $10,000 or 30 days in jail, but that's an option that the judge has. So I think this is one small step to save lives and to help change the culture. And I think the best way of dealing with things in society is to have the norms of society change, but laws, I think, help that change. People will pay attention to a law oftentimes. Because it is the law, people will pay attention to it because of the penalty. And oftentimes people will pay attention after they've been caught doing something a couple of times. And then if the penalty for a repeat is high enough, that will, I think, help to change the behavior. So I think this is a good bill, and there are some other people here who will testify, and I appreciate your indulgence. Thank you.
All right, Senator Morissette, thank you. Any questions for Senator Morissette? There are none. Thank you very much. All right, I've got Pamela Erickson, or coalition to reduce underage drinking.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Pamela Erickson. I'm the director of the Coalition to Reduce Underage Drinking. I'm here to talk about the background and the need for greater penalties for furnishing alcohol to minors. As you know, underage drinking is this state's most serious alcohol problem. Kids are drinking at very high levels and earlier ages. I always find it surprising to realize that 1 in 4 eighth graders in this state report drinking last month. We also now know that if a youngster begins drinking before age 15, their chances of being an addict as an adult are four times greater than if they waited until 21. Underage drinking is related to all of the leading causes of death of our young people. It's related to academic failure and to impairment of social and physical development. Clearly, the future of our young people is adversely affected by underage drinking. One of the best strategies to combat underage drinking is to reduce access, that is, make it harder for kids to get alcohol. We've made a lot of progress in this state in some ways. In the early 90s, a kid that was 15 could probably walk into most stores and pick up their own alcohol. But by focusing on enforcing our laws, that's much less likely now. But kids turn to other methods. And one of the methods that they use frequently is furnishing by adults or older youth. I'd like to turn your attention to the Oregon Healthy Teen Survey where kids were asked where they got alcohol. And among 11th graders, most of them get their alcohol from furnishers. The most common method is for someone over 21, but they also get alcohol from older youth that are not quite 21. When they were asked how easy it is to get alcohol from someone over 21, 64% said very easy. Another 21% said sort of easy. So obviously kids are having no trouble getting alcohol from furnishers. Even eighth graders thought it was pretty easy to get alcohol from adults. That's pretty shocking for me, but I think it's true. Clearly, we need to do more about the issue of furnishing alcohol to minors. We have a lot of good tools in this state to deal with underage drinking. Our keg registration law allows us to identify furnishers. Our social host laws make homeowners liable when they host underage parties. And recently, our coalition partners have been working on illegal party interdiction. But more serious penalties are needed to increase the deterrent effect. And finally, more serious penalties would provide the opportunity to educate the public about this issue and to send the message to would-be furnishers that this state will not tolerate providing alcohol to our kids. Thank you very much.
All right. Any questions?
Mr. Chairman.
Sorry. Yes, go ahead.
The way I read this bill, it looks pretty inclusive. For one thing, it changes liquor to beverage, which is a good thing because
yes.
Alcohol is alcohol.
That's correct.
But it also, there is an exemption for a parent who, for example, my daughter and I were recently at a Seder where a sip of wine is part of the ceremony, and that was something that she was allowed to participate in because she's almost 16. But if you're in a restaurant and you were to offer your child a sip of wine or something, would that invoke all these penalties? Because it was an outside server who provided that.
Senator Burdick, I believe that would just be a violation of this law. You can't do that today. The issue of parents providing alcohol to their children, I believe, was designed to recognize those cultures where wine is served with a meal, and a child learns the proper use of alcohol at their own dinner table. A parent is only allowed to furnish their own child in their own home under their supervision. They can't furnish other children or parties or anything like that.
Okay, counsel.
Mr. Chairman, ma'am, what about a religious situation like church?
I'm not really sure. I would have to go back and look at the statute. I think there's some allowance for that, but you're going to have to ask somebody who knows that for sure.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Counsel, I'm having a little difficulty reading this thing the way it's constructed, too. I'm just wondering if it might not be easier to reconstruct this whole statute so that it actually reads a little easier. To get into subsection 4, it's except as provided in subsection 5 of the section, blah, 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 and then it goes on except as provided in subsection 7, blah, blah, blah. Seems like we're doing the do-si-do here. And maybe we can rewrite this so that it makes a little bit more sense. Mr. Steubenbaum. OLCC wants to weigh in on this one.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Good morning. My name is John Steubenbaum. I'm the Communications Director for the Oregon Liquor Control Commission. Mr. Chair, I appreciate your comments, and I would like to try and walk you through what the legislation does do. But first, we'd certainly like to concur with the comments that you've heard from Senator Morissette and Ms. Erickson. Alcohol use by minors in this state and really across the nation is a very serious public health problem, as well as a developmental problem for our young people. And what this legislation is designed to do is to fall into part of a balanced enforcement scheme that the legislature has put in place over the years. Certainly Ms. Erickson talked about law enforcement efforts are being successful in ensuring that unintentional sales to minors through stores are less frequent than they were years ago. So what this legislation is designed to do is to get at what's commonly called shoulder tapping, adults who willfully furnish alcohol to minors. What the legislation does really is two things. The first thing that the legislation does is to amend current statute to significantly increase the fines for an adult who intentionally furnishes alcohol to minors. And you'll find that beginning on line 21 of page 1, subsection 4. You can see that those fines are substantially increased. At the same time, while the fines are substantially increased for what we would call shoulder tappers, adults who intentionally furnish to a minor, the intent of the legislation is to carry on the existing statute, the existing statutory fines for a store clerk, a liquor license holder, or an OLCC liquor agent who in effect makes a mistake and through a business transaction sells alcohol to a minor. And that's, Mr. Chair, as you indicated, the construction of this legislation that's a bit difficult. You'll find that language on page 2, beginning at line 14, the new sub 7. So what you see in the sub 7 is really a carry forward of the existing statute, the existing level of fine that would be carried forward for a liquor agent or a licensee who in effect makes a mistake during the course of a business transaction. And while I'm on this point, Mr. Chair, I would respectfully encourage the committee to adopt the Dash 1 amendments, which would add to this subsection by...
John, I don't think we have...
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair.
Dash 1 amendment.
Okay. I apologize, Mr. Chair. I assume you had those.
I do not.
Okay.
Who are they?
Mr. Chair, quite simply, the Dash 1 amendments clean up an omission in the drafting of this legislation and simply add employees of the liquor license holder or the liquor agent to those who would pay the existing level of fine should they, in effect, make a mistake.
Okay.
So essentially what the legislation proposes to do is to make a distinction between an adult who intentionally furnishes alcohol to a minor and a business transaction where a liquor license holder, an agent, or an employee makes a mistake. In effect, that's what this proposes to do. The second thing that the legislation does, which begins on line 29, the bottom of page 1, is it adds new language to the statute, which would give a local district attorney another tool in the toolbox. And this tool would be a pretty heavy hammer to address a very egregious situation where you had an adult who furnished alcohol to a minor. The minor consumes the alcohol, subsequently injures or kills him or herself or another person. This new language, which is the new, would be the new sub 5, would allow a local district attorney to file felony charges against an individual in that situation. And with that, Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to respond to questions. And again, I apologize for you not having that amendment. I don't know what happened there.
All right. Any questions for
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Burke.
Can you elaborate on the religious exemptions for this type of thing? We wouldn't want to see that type of activity get wrapped into this.
Mr. Chair, Senator Brick, I apologize for not being able to cite the precise statute. I'd be happy to get back to you on that. But yes, there is in current statute an exemption for sacramental religious purposes for alcoholic beverages. And I'd be happy to get back with you, show you that statutory cite. But there is a cite, a current cite in statute.
And that would cover this legislation as well, that exemption?
Mr. Chair, Senator Burdick, certainly. The current, this legislation is not intended to impede current statutory exemptions for sacramental religious purposes.
All right. Any other questions? There are no other questions.
Thank you very much,
John. Appreciate it. We'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 895. And I think we need a little bit of work on that, plus the dash one amendments before we proceed. Let's go back quickly to House Bill 2811, and I think 3339. Do a public hearing on both of them at this time, because I think we have Kelly Peterson signed up on both of those, and Mr. Stonebank, who's now leaving the room. No, he's looking for Kelly.
Yeah, 2811
and 3339. All right, you guys are experienced. You all know the drill. State your name for the record. Tell us what you want to tell us. Who's first?
Okay. Chairman Minnis and committee members, my name is Kelly Peterson, and I'm the Oregon Program Coordinator with the Humane Society of the United States, and I'm here today to offer testimony in support of House Bill 2811. This bill, as well as House Bill 3339, comes out of a working group that consisted of the Oregon Department of Agriculture, the Oregon Veterinary Medical Association, the Oregon Dairy Farmers Association, and the Oregon Cattlemen's Association. And we held several meetings and then participated in numerous conversations afterwards to find concepts that were agreeable to all of us. And we believe that both bills today would achieve important and necessary clarifications and additions to existing law. And House Bill 2811A is very simple and straightforward. It just would define and clarify minimum care standards for a person in possession of a non-ambulatory animal. And that's an animal that can't walk or stand on its own. And the bill would just simply require a person to either provide immediate and ongoing care to restore the animal to an ambulatory state or euthanize the animal. And in the current minimum care statute, that could be implied, but it's not specifically outlined. And our goal really here collectively was just to minimize the suffering of non-ambulatory animals. And House Bill 2811 would just simply set a standard of care for non-ambulatory livestock animals. And so with that, I'll just turn over to you.
For the record, Glenn Stonebrink with the Oregon Cattlemen's Association, and on this bill I'm also representing the Oregon Hay and Forage Association. On 2811, I guess we'll address just one at a time, if you wish, Mr. Chair.
You do.
We work, as Kelly said, we work with, in a working group, and we have no problems with this definition, and I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions?
I do have questions, Chair.
Senator Federer.
The only term of definition that has me concerned or creates a question in my mind is the definition of humane euthanasia. And I'd like to have a little discussion about that for the record. And the reason I need to ask that question is that the district I represent is could be defined probably federally as frontier. And lots of the folks that raise livestock in the area that I represent, 34,000 square miles, do so in relatively remote locations. Grazing allotments can be miles from any facilities, veterinary or otherwise, and often they're accessible not even by road. Some are located in wilderness areas. They're accessible by horseback. In those circumstances, if you came upon an animal who was, in fact, non-ambulatory, there are probably very few options for immediate humane care. So under those circumstances, let me hear a little discussion about what you would expect euthanasia to consist of.
He wants to know if you can pull your six-shooter out and shoot an animal.
Yeah. I want it on the record, Mr. Chairman.
Well, folks do it from time to time, even in the city of Portland. So.
Mr. Chair, Senator Fraioli, I'll take a shot at it. Having been in the business and having this only happen on one occasion, I don't know of any rancher that would not know the most humane way, and I'll describe it. It may sound gory, but I'll describe it, is that in livestock's skull, if you imagine the horns and the eyes, and where if you drew a line from this horn to this eye and this line, this horn to this eye, right where those lines cross is the softest part of the skull, and even a small caliber pistol or rifle would immediately hit the brain and kill it instantly. And if that's, and I'm glad you asked that for the record, and if that's acceptable to Humane Society as a humanely way of euthanizing, I'd be happy to have that on the record.
Kelly, respond, please.
Yeah. Chair Minnis and Senator Ferrioli, that is something that is acceptable to us. We actually had asked for a definition of mechanical, you know, clarifying what humane euthanasia is, and it's not in a statute, but it would be whatever, you know, good animal husbandry is, and shooting an animal quickly is.
But you don't have to chase it around and lethally inject the things.
No, if there are other options, of course.
Right.
Yeah. Well, Mr. Chairman, thank you. I appreciate that. I apologize for making people uncomfortable with that concept, but the idea is that circumstances in these cases will be different in each case, and I'm glad there is no definition of humane euthanasia, because I think that, you know, must be the least painful, most serviceable mechanism available.
We aren't attempting to alter at all how an animal is euthanized in the livestock industry. It's just the care that the non-ambulatory animal receives.
Okay. Well, all right. Well, and actually, it doesn't just affect very rural areas. The Portland Police Bureau and other agencies from time to time do have to humanely euthanize an animal of some sort that's wandered into. I mean, interestingly, we get elk that show up in the middle of Glendiver Park, you know, that injure themselves, and you know, something has to be done. We obviously have veterinarians and others that can respond more quickly there, but know, from time to time we have had officers that have euthanized animals, and I wouldn't want to necessarily change that protocol. So,
thank you, Mr. Chairman.
All right. Tell me on 3339, what exactly is the problem we're fixing? Trade in non-ambulatory animals?
Yeah, this is something that, Chairman and committee members, this is an issue that as a working group we initially had formed to address animals that cannot walk or stand on their own. We just feel as though it's the Humane Society, and I believe, I don't know if I'm speaking out of turn, but I think the other groups are accept this as well, that it's very difficult to humanely transport a livestock animal, well, basically put them on trucks and off trucks. And so we're just trying to get at the ability or the inability of someone to haul an animal onto a truck and off a truck to an auction market. And in fact, one of the other people who were part of our working group was the owner of the Lebanon auction market, and he in fact has had cases where non-ambulatory animals are delivered or attempted to deliver to his facility, and he has a position where he doesn't accept them because he doesn't know what to do with them. They're obviously animals that are sick or maybe injured, and so this is something that is not accepted by the livestock community, but it does happen on occasion, and that's really what we're trying to prevent.
You know, it's amazing to me. Years ago when I became a policeman in Portland, we used to have the stockyards up in North Portland, and I actually got a call one night when the livestock got out. Now imagine me, city boy, in a Portland police uniform, trying to figure out what to do with all these cows. I was inept, trust me. All right.
Mr. Chair, I just might add that Kelly mentioned the livestock auction owner. He and also the president of the Livestock Auction Association testified on the House side, actually Coy and the, excuse me, I don't want to say it wrong, Mr. Cowart, who owns 11 and Auction, was part of the work group, and then I think it was Bruce Andrew, who was the president of the Livestock Auction Association. He testified on the House side that this bill would actually help them because there are people who have attempted, and I don't necessarily want to pick on an industry, but usually the dairy industry, who have attempted to bring down or non-ambulatory animals to their auction to try to make a sale. The auction yard owner said this, they could simply point to this law and say, don't even try it because I would be committing a crime if I accepted it. And so it would probably, once this bill is passed, would stop that. And that's the main purpose of the whole bill.
All right.
Mr. Chair, my name is Marcia Keith. I'm here today representing the Oregon Veterinary Medical Association, and you have written testimony from the OVMA on both of those bills. I would just like to go on record in support of both bills. We participated in the work groups and the discussions, and feel that both bills make necessary and laudatory changes to current law.
All right. Thank you, Marcia. Questions, Senator Brady.
Chairman, to my knowledge, we don't have mad cow disease yet in this country. But aren't the symptoms, if it ever were to reach this country, aren't the symptoms something like what you might see in a downed animal situation?
Mr. Chair, Senator Brady, correct on the first point that we do not have that disease in this country. And we have a very good system to keep that from happening, but it's an ongoing process. The second part of your question is that also, yes, is that they could show those symptoms as far as being a downed animal. However, they show other symptoms that I can't imagine anybody but an absolute fool who would ever try to do that, because you're totally risking the entire livestock industry if you do anything else other than to call the state veterinarian and immediately dispose of the animal. And then it sets off an alert that such a disease is in the country, and we've worked very hard to eradicate those diseases. So, but yes, they could have the same symptoms.
Okay, Mr. Chair, to follow up, are there other diseases besides mad cow diseases that livestock can have that would be transmissible or harmful to humans?
Mr. Chair, Senator Burdick, there is a disease called Yoni's disease. It can be transferred to people. But these are very remote possibilities. I think there is one other one that has like no chance, but under experiments, lab experiments, they think it could be, and forget the name, but very, very small chance that animals could transmit, the cattle could transmit to humans. All right.
Any further questions? One question. Senator Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was out of the room, and I came back during this discussion. Are you telling me, Ms. Peterson, that you're supporting a bill, this 2811, which would allow shooting animals?
Chairman and Senator Walker, we just would like the animal humanely euthanized, and it's quick and as less painful as possible. So that is, I believe, that is standard within the livestock industry, is shooting an animal, and that's not what we're attempting to do here. Yeah. What we have an issue with is animals that, you know, are very sick, are injured, that can't get to food or water or get immediate care. And those are animals that usually languish. And those are downers or non-ambulatory animals. Okay. And it's prolonged suffering. And that's something that we obviously would want to eliminate. And we would want the animal euthanized in a reasonable way and the most effective, quick way possible.
Well, the reason I asked that, Ms. Peterson, is because I just read about a dog who'd been shot by a police officer because the officer thought the dog was injured and wanted to put it out of its misery. It got thrown in the freezer, and then when it was taken out of the freezer, the dog was still alive, and now it's with a family and recovering and seems to be suffering nothing further from its injuries, which is a total miracle and
what
a surprise.
Is that?
Yeah, it was in California.
So I just want to be sure that
send
when
back
we
to the range.
Shoot these animals, they know what they're
right.
doing.
In that situation, I really believe there were other methods.
Thank you.
What agency was that?
It was a police officer, and I don't know which agency, but I'll find out.
I saw it on the news
the other night.
Yeah.
That's bad decision making. No good deed ever goes unpunished, Mr.
So don't go shooting the cows.
I tried to shoot a dog one time. It came out a window and bit me on the arm while I was trying to arrest its master. That really ticked me off. But then, you know what happened? I pulled my gun out and stuck in his face. That dog understood the seriousness of the situation because it took off to the other side of the car and cowered. And I don't know why, but that was the worst injury I think I've ever suffered. Because dog bites hurt like crazy. But that dog understood the other end of the barrel of a gun. It was amazing. Anyway, that's a true story here. All right, we're going to close the public hearing on these two bills and open a public hearing on House Bill 2034. We have Robert Beauvais. I believe I'm pronouncing that correct. It looks French, and I probably screwed it up, but in Larry Welty. Is there a member of the media in my...
What's been the story about the police officer shooting the dog?
All right. If you two, I think you've both been here before. State your name for the record and tell us what you need to tell us.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, Senators. My name is Rob Beauvais, Assistant County Counsel from Lincoln County. I'm here today in my capacity as legal counsel for our narcotics team in Lincoln County, Lint, and also as legal advisor to the Oregon Narcotics Enforcement Association. House Bill 2034 is basically, for the most part, cleanup legislation from House Bill 3661 from 2001, which is a bill we brought to you last session to dramatically update and improve our precursor laws. Precursors are the chemicals that are used to manufacture controlled substances, and in this state and throughout the Pacific Northwest, the primary precursors and the controlled substances we're worried about are methamphetamine. The precursors listed in our state law, the bulk of them that we regulate are basically the common household chemicals that are used to make meth. What I have for you here today is just some materials here, that most of which I'll just go through very briefly and then turn it over to Mr. Welty. Primarily on page 2 of my testimony, I go through section by section and explain why we're making the technical amendments in House Bill 2034 to update and clean up some technical issues that arose as a result of the implementation of House Bill 3661. And particularly, it affected some veterinarians in ways that we did not intend. It affected some other industry products in ways that we did not intend. And certainly, we're happy to bring House Bill 2034 to fix those issues. I would also like to just point out briefly, we spend a lot more time in detail on the House side, but I know you're critical for time here. Late in the session. I'll just mention some of the stats that are now finalized from Oregon that we talked about in the House, and I have a kind of a handout of a slideshow I did for the House, and I'll just point out a few of these stats just to let you know that while at the same time we have suffered well over a 40% reduction in the number of drug enforcement officers we have in the state of Oregon over the last 6 months to a year, and that is before the recent reductions in the state police. So we've suffered a dramatic and severe reduction in the number of narcotics officers enforcing these laws, while at the same time, our stats for meth labs are still dramatic and shocking. The last year's stat, which has recently been revised, but as of a month ago was 508. I think the final number was, I think, around 523 meth labs throughout the state of Oregon that law enforcement officers took down. I'm specifically referring to page 5 of my kind of slideshow. Of those in excess of 500 labs last year, 9 of them exploded. 10 of them were super labs. Super labs are basically labs that are capable of generating upwards of 10 pounds or more of pure meth at a time. 5 in Marion County, 1 in Lynn, 1 in Clackamas, Coos, Tillamook, and Washington, respectively. At those labs, 108 children were rescued from those lab sites, 50 of whom were chemically exposed. And you see the age brackets there on page 5. There were also 2 children who were injured in an exploded lab. And you can see the volume of weapons and automatic weapons seized. And if you're interested in where your particular county places, if you hit the top 10, you'll see that on the bottom of page 5. Lincoln County has the dubious distinction of being in the top 10 for 2 years consecutive now, and you can see by our population, we really shouldn't be there, but we are, regrettably. The last thing I guess I'd point out to you, and then I'll turn it over to Mr. Welty and offer to answer any questions, is on the last page of my testimony, page 4, I have this sheet entitled Requiring Certain Ephedrine Products Be Kept Behind the Counter. This was one additional thing we had proposed in House Judiciary Committee that we add to House Bill 2034, was the requirement that certain pseudoephedrine and ephedrine products be kept behind the counter in retail outlets. I got to tell you, a lot of retail outlets are doing that voluntarily because that's the primary precursor used to manufacture meth. We've had so many shoplift incidents throughout the state of Oregon that a lot of retailers were voluntarily doing that anyways. We had proposed to require that that be universal throughout the state of Oregon, and that met with, well, quite a lot of opposition, to say the least, on the House side. So rather than fight that at that time, we decided we needed to move House Bill 2034 across. Some of the primary arguments that were thrown against that proposal that we had back then was that it would affect too many products. It would require approximately 60 linear feet of products to be placed behind the counter, requiring your modeling of stores and a variety of things be done. And I guess, importantly, no other state had gone there, so we were asking you to go where no one else had gone before. Since that time, since being on the House side, I got to let you know that Washington has introduced a bill to place pseudoephedrine products or certain products behind the counter. Missouri has introduced a bill to place certain pseudoephedrine products behind the counter. It passed last month in the Missouri House of Representatives, and as of Monday, it had passed out of the Senate Judiciary Committee in Missouri with a due pass recommendation. What I'm afraid of is that if we don't address certain pseudoephedrine products being placed behind the counter now, that when I come back to you in 2005, that we will have already sunk further into the abyss and we'll be back to where we were in 2001 trying to catch up with everybody else who's chased their meth cooks to Oregon again. So what we've drafted up, and it's not in the form of a dash amendment, it's just a conceptual amendment that Mr. Welty will be talking about and we've presented, is just a narrow amendment to require two particular pseudoephedrine products be kept behind the counter in retail outlets and their generic equivalents. So you're talking about a total of four products. We would like you to consider that. It's kind of a last-ditch effort to throw that out at you. We'd certainly like that included in House Bill 2034. Wouldn't be surprised if the industry is not real receptive to that. But again, it seems to be the trend, and it seems to be passing in other states. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions you have about House Bill 2034 and what we're doing in any of the particular sections.
Right. With respect to the pseudoephedrine issue, putting it behind the counter, that may restrict retail sales and such, but would we see a corresponding increase in burglaries?
We haven't in Lincoln County, Mr. Chair, we haven't in Lincoln County. We have a number of stores that have voluntarily done that, and all we've seen is that it reduces the incidence of shoplifting and what we call smurfing at those particular stores. Smurfing is where you have someone that, based on the constraints of House Bill 3661, goes up and down, say, the I-5 corridor or the 101 corridor and goes to various stores buying a few products.
Right.
We haven't seen any burglaries of these products. We have seen a reduction in the sales of these products for the illicit purposes that we're trying to prevent. So we've seen it actually work in those stores that have voluntarily done this in any event.
Well, wouldn't you also want to do the same thing with diamond matches, because you take the red phosphorus from the boxes and scrape it off?
Mr. Chair, I think that's also a good idea. However, I think this is the better first step, in the sense that the red phosphorus on the matches is only used in the second generation meth labs, whereas we're seeing an upsurge in the third generation Nazi meth labs that doesn't require red phosphorus, whereas pseudoephedrine is the necessary prerequisite to either a second-generation Red P lab or a third-generation Nazi lab. It's the critical component.
Right. Wouldn't we be better off to have a mandatory minimum prison sentence for these yo-yos?
Mr. Chair, I'd love to say yes to that, but I know that opens up a whole other discussion about...
It depends on how much victimization we want.
Sure.
How many more of these idiots wandering around making this stuff and shooting it in their bodies and killing themselves and killing their kids?
Mr. Chair, I couldn't agree more. On the other hand, I guess in a very selfish way, what we try to do in House Bill 3661 and what we're trying to do here again in 2034 and with our additional suggestion is essentially chase meth cooks out of Oregon.
Where are we going to chase them to?
Well, California.
East Coast. California. They're already starting to show up in South Carolina. So.
Mr. Chair, they are. California did a real successful job about 3 years ago chasing them all up the I-5 corridor to Oregon and Washington. And I think we've done a somewhat successful job in continuing to chase them up to Canada. Now, Canada has recently woken up, and they've got some pretty aggressive legislation they're looking at as well.
That's a pretty remote place to build a prison, too, don't they?
Mr. Chair, I would agree. What I guess I would point out to you on the pseudoephedrine behind the counter issue is the best thing I can show you is an actual statement from someone who's currently serving time for being a smurfer, a pseudoephedrine smurfer. And it's the bolded quote I got from you on the last page of my testimony, where he describes what he believes would be the biggest impact on people that are in his business, which is, he says, you know, I'll just quote from him, if pulled from store shelves, this would put a major roadblock for anyone who wants to manufacture meth, because if you don't have easy access to this product, you'll have less meth. And I couldn't agree more. And again, we're not even asking you to go as far as Missouri's going. We would like to just see you kind of... We did some statistical analysis, and I'll just show you the two products. There are two products out there that we're talking about that we would like to get off the shelves, and it's these two products and their generic equivalents. This is the bulk of the two products used as the base ingredient. I mean, just to be blunt.
I fed yesterday.
You want to put them behind the counter.
Oh, I just want them behind the counter.
Right.
Now, the original amendment we drafted on the House side would have required all pseudoephedrine products be placed behind the counter, and that met with quite a huge amount of opposition. And we talked about 60 linear feet of stuff, remodeling Walmarts. I mean, it got real gory for a while. So we would like to tailor some, you know, very narrow legislation to at least focus on the critical products that seem to be smirked, shoplift.
All right, Senator Burdick, I think you have a question. Council has a question. Well, Senator Walker has a question.
Oh, Mr. Chairman, when they're behind the counter, is there a limit on how many the people can buy?
Mr. Chair, Senator Burdick, in House Bill 3661, you enacted what has become the national standard, which is a 9-gram limitation on the sale, possession of pseudoephedrine. Actually, some states are actually going down to 6 grams now, but what that translates to is under federal law, you can only have a maximum of 3 grams of pseudoephedrine in any particular packaged product. So the baseline kind of standard that a lot of retailers are going by, if they haven't already encoded their machines, is you can sell or purchase or possess maximum of 3 of these things at any given time.
Okay, so if, Mr. Chairman, follow up, if somebody were stopped in their car and like 10 or 12 of these were found, would that be a cause for them?
Mr. Chair, Senator Burdick, that's correct. In fact, this gentleman here, who apparently is serving time at the Lane County Community Corrections Center, is serving time, I presume, under the statute you enacted back in 2001 in House Bill 3661 for possessing more than the allowed amount. Now, my guess is, you know, knowing the meth cooks that I know, that he probably had maybe a few hundred of these things, you know, because he had been spending time. Because it's not a meth cook to make a meth lab reasonably productive, even for personal use. You're not going to want just 3 of these or even 6 of these. You're going to want dozens and dozens of these.
If you had to guess how many manufacturers you have floating around in your county, could you give me a sense?
Meth lab cooks,
right,
Mr. Chair?
Cooks. Well, I mean, the cooks can be some idiot that they brought into the recipe I'm talking about.
Yeah, it can be. The numbers are shocking. A recent study that just came out at the end of last year, a multi-year study from the Los Angeles area, HIDA, indicates that on average a meth cook teaches 5 to 6 other people how to cook meth on average in any given year. And that's how meth cooks typically learn. They don't typically learn off the internet and off books, which was a surprise to me. So it's exponentially growing. And so it's hard to quantify. I can tell you that the trend, until we lost the bulk of lint due to various budget cuts and other things I won't bore you with, the trend was we had gone from 1 lab to 2 labs to 4 labs to 24 labs. That was our stats. So we were on a curve that was going amazingly high. And if we had lint still fully operational, I would anticipate that curve would be still as astronomically high.
Do you have any of the folks that you might, without mentioning their names, that you would identify as prolific in their manufacture of the product?
Mr. Chair, that would probably be a good word. We have what we call repeat customers. Prolific might be another word for it as well. Third, fourth time cooks that keep getting arrested over and over again. Eventually they build up enough of a record or under other things that you enacted back in 2001, they either go to state prison for a short time, or eventually they get enough of a record, we send them federally and they serve some substantial time. But it usually takes quite a bit of a record.
All right. Any other questions? Senator Walker. I'm sorry, Senator Burdick. I'm lost now. You're done. Council, did you?
I'm sorry, but you put up 2 packages, right, of Sudafed, and the other one is that how you plan to define within the narrow definition? How you plan to define the product, or you plan to define it by its makeup?
Council, the way I've just drafted it conceptually, and again, it's not in any form of dash amendment, is I define these products narrowly by the ingredients, the active ingredients. This has 1 active ingredient. This has 2 active ingredients. They're in tablet form. They're not in liquid form. And so I basically describe the narrow product. Now, I'm not sure if that would meet with legislative council approval. I would think it would. I avoided trying to name manufacturers and products. Didn't want to even go there.
Okay, thank you.
All right, Senator Walker.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. A couple of concerns come to my mind. One is, Mr. Bovette, that I used to do court reporting for federal grand jury in Eugene for 3 years, and I got sick of it because I got tired of hearing about the meth cases. It was tragic. But one of the things I did learn in my 3 years of doing that was that These meth cooks always find a new precursor chemical. We're always having to reclassify a chemical as a precursor. So I just get a little concerned that now we're going to classify these. They have been for a long time. We're going to put them behind the counter, and then they're going to develop something else. We're going to put that behind the counter. We had testimony from a representative from AOI that they put Infamil behind the counter now because people steal that. Pretty soon, we're not going to find many products on the open store shelves. We're going to have to go behind the locked cabinets. So, I don't know. Just sort of tell me how you're going to address that.
Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, I'm not sure that I can really fully answer that. I can tell you that since about the mid-1980s, that both the second and third generation meth labs, so we're talking upwards of 20 years, the primary precursor is this, pseudoephedrine. We only have regulated it since 2001. We were very late in addressing this. We were way behind times in Oregon. We were behind all of our neighbors. And my fear is that with other states enacting stronger precursor regulations than us, we will again be faced with a situation where Oregon will look like an attractive place to come get your products and make meth.
And then I think yesterday, Dr. Bates, Representative Bates, sent his staff out to get me some Sudafed, and I think she brought back two boxes because I think she got some for someone else. But I mean, you're saying that you could only have three of these in your possession, and otherwise you break the law.
Mr. Chair, Representative Walker, not exactly. The maximum amount of pseudoephedrine that can be packaged in one of these is 3 grams. As a practical matter, most of them have a whole lot less than that. And there is also an exemption you built into the law in 2001 in House Bill 3661 that allows for up to 24 grams in your home.
Okay.
So there's like what we call the medicine cabinet exemption as well. So we tried to design it that no one, even with the most extended family and the most severe allergies, would be impacted on a personal level to that degree. We were trying to define a very broad line that allowed for all those legitimate uses. And so far as I know, that hasn't been an issue or a problem since House Bill 3661 has been enacted. And we're not asking you to go lower than 9 grams, although, again, as I mentioned before, a lot of the states are going down to 6, including California.
All right. That answers that question. Thank you.
All right. Additional questions? Do you have some testimony? I'm sitting here patiently listening.
Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Larry Welty. I'm the president of the Oregon Narcotics Enforcement Association. And last year I retired as the commander of the Oregon State Police Drug Enforcement Section. I am here today to ask for your support with House Bill 2034. And also I have attached to my testimony the proposed amendment that Mr. Bovette has talked about. I think it is a good remedy to the situation we came up with the Retailers Association regarding a large number of products that they were assuming would have to be put behind the counter because they contained pseudoephedrine. And that was not our goal. We're not seeing these other products being used because in many cases they can't use them because the pseudoephedrine that is contained is such a minute amount that it would be a waste of their time to try and convert it. Issue is the two processes, as Mr. Bovette said, that are currently being used in the state of Oregon is the ammonia process, which is has been coined the Nazi process, and the red phosphorus hydriotic acid process. Both of those processes, you cannot produce methamphetamine if you do not have pseudoephedrine or ephedrine. You just can't do it. The process that preceded that was the P2P process. We saw that a number of years ago. We started controlling those chemicals and were very successful in reducing the number of labs, and that they've now come up with this process, and I have a feeling that this will work as well. And I just encourage you to really consider this behind the counter issue, because as Mr. Bavette had said, this individual that is in jail that had made these statements about how they operated, we knew this was going on. We knew there was large groups going up and down I-5. The state police had two seizures, large seizures of pills that were headed to lab sites up in the Portland area, where individuals had gone to a number of locations throughout that area and stolen pseudoephedrine products, broke them down out of their packages, rebagged them, and secreted them into their vehicles. So, I mean, it's a very popular item for people to trade for what they call finished product, which is the methamphetamine themselves. So with that, I'll just conclude my testimony.
All right. Thank you very much. Appreciate it. Marcia Keith, I'm assuming you support the amendment. Yeah, that's it.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Marcia Keith with Oregon Veterinary Medical Association, here to speak in support of 2034A, and to thank Mr. Bovet and the Oregon State Police for fixing a problem that occurred with last session's passage of House Bill 3661. It was an unintended consequence that caught veterinarians by surprise. Many veterinarians treat their patients with medications that contain pseudoephedrine iodine and need to use greater quantities of that medication than 3661 would allow. 2034 fixes that for veterinarians. And for example, in the course of a treatment for a horse with upper respiratory distress, known as a horse with heaves, you could only give 9 grams of the product that would, the pseudoephedrine product that would treat that horse, and that horse needs many, many more grams than that and needs it in an ongoing situation, so that the veterinarian would actually sell the product to the horse's owner, who would then treat the horse with it over time. And the House Bill 3661 would have prevented that. House Bill 2034 fixes that, and regardless of whatever else happens with the bill, we would certainly like to see the veterinarian provisions stay in it and be passed. Ask you for your support.
Thank you. I share your testimony, Marcia. Any further closing comments? Anyone else wishing to testify on this bill? For some reason, I'm getting old, I think. Yes. There you go. Ms. Brandis. Sorry, my brain went dead on me here.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, for the record, I'm Julie Brandis. As we did in the House, we and other retail association groups would have to oppose putting any product behind the counter. I think Senator Walker brought up a very good point, and it reminds me of a piece of legislation a couple of years ago where the latest craze was taking hits off whipped cream. Mm-hmm. And do you remember this bill? And the House Judiciary Committee, I always try to bring a little levity to the committee, but the House Judiciary Committee wanted to put whipped cream behind the counter, which, you know, it puts retailers in a very precarious position. We are already limited by a law that she passed last session on how much we can sell, the 9-gram limit. Now, if we are forced to put it behind the counter, it puts us in this awkward, almost police representative state, because we already have to, we're already scanning and saying, okay, you've reached your 9 gram limit, you can't purchase any more of this single or combined product. So if you buy Tylenol cold for your child at the same time you might be Sudafed, buying Sudafed for yourself and maybe Actifed for your husband, you've reached that limit. It's about, I think, about three products. I'm not exactly sure. Now you're putting us in a position of having to stop the course of our business to open up our behind-the-counter sale of, you know, to say what is it you actually want, and the customer having to compare. They'll still be able to buy at the 9 gram limit. So they'll be able to, if smurfing is a problem, right now they can go and smurf in the store at the 9 gram limit, go to the next door neighbor store and buy at the 9 gram limit, go down the street and buy at the 9 gram limit. They'll still be able to do that if it's behind the counter. We in our stores have, as you've heard, have in many cases, and especially in certain areas of the state, have voluntarily put some of the product behind the counter, and just as we do with the formula, with the Actifed products, are putting a majority of it behind the counter, so we only have one on the shelf, like the Enfamil, the example you brought up. We keep one on the shelf so it doesn't get shoplifted at an increased rate. So those are some of the concerns we would have with putting it behind the counter. It's something we did lobby aggressively against on the House side. And it is something, also last session on 3661, we did work with Mr. Beauvais on that. It was a great effort on both the retailer and the law enforcement parts, both of our sides.
All right. Thank you, Julie. Question?
Yeah.
Concern? Comment?
Comment. Ms. Brenda, side, one of the issues you brought up is, yeah, people are going to have to stand there and compare. I don't just go up and buy a particular product. I'm going to look to see how much of one ingredient's in another, what the price is. Who's going to have time to stand there while each person comes up and looks behind the locked cabinet? So that, again, was my concern, too. And as you pointed out, you can still buy it, even if it's behind the counter.
Right, and it's a legal drug.
All right, thank you very much. We're going to close the public hearing. What bill was that, for gosh sake?
2034.
Close that public hearing. Open the public hearing on 2821. And we have Mr. Bay, Brian Wallace, Marshall Ross, and Tim Leader to open chat with us about camp. I'm slow to
speed super. Well, my stuff's dangerous. It's a goofy.
All right. If you would, just introduce yourself again for the record and proceed.
Good morning again, Mr. Chair, Senators. Again, my name is Rob Bovet, Assistant County Counsel, this time wearing my hat as, I guess, interim legal advisor to the State Sheriff's Association while their attorney is otherwise occupied. House Bill 2821, I'm largely going to leave up to the experts to talk about the details because they know about how this stuff really works in reality. I'll just go through the sections real quickly with you to let you know why you're looking at these particular sections. Sections 1 to 4 of the bill are designed to fix some technical glitches that arose from the Oregon Law Commission's House Bill 2386, which was the big garnishment reform bill last time. And sections 1 to 4 fix some technical things that they, one of which they inadvertently deleted and repealed accidentally, and a few other technical things within the garnishment statutes that need to be cleaned up so we can get our timing issues straightened out. Sections 5 to 8 update and clarify service fees for process fees. As you can see from my written testimony, we haven't updated those for quite some time. They're currently at $25. We had originally proposed to raise them to $30 for the basic service fee. Worked out a compromise in House Judiciary and settled on $28. So that's what we settled on. Sections 9 to 16 of the bill are designed to smooth out the process for serving restraining orders in areas that are adjacent to county boundaries. So if you've got someone that lives in one area and works in another county, you don't have to have the sheriff's civil deputy stop at the county line, go back to his office, mail the papers over to the other sheriff, and have them service the papers, therefore, you know, having a 5, 6, 7 day delay in the service of one of these critical restraining orders. So that's a real quick outline of the bill and what it would do. And with that, I'll turn it over to the rest of the folks.
All right. You would?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Senior Deputy Marshall Ross with the Multnomah County Sheriff's Office Civil Unit, and Mr. Beauvais was hit the nail right on the head with his succinct explanation of House Bill 2821. When the garnishment chapter was rewritten last legislative session, and Chapter 29 was omitted in its entirety, inadvertently, the language that allowed the sheriff to enter into someone's premises on a replevant action, which is the repossession of personal property, was omitted from the statute. And now the sheriff is left without any statutory guidance as to how to proceed in executing these types of court orders. This bill would restore the language that was deleted back into statute, with one addition that was not in the previous statute, and that's the wording where it says at a specific premises. We're asking that these words be included into statute, as that would explicitly direct the sheriff to a specific premises. Sheriffs want to be ministerial when we're executing civil court orders. We want the court to tell us exactly where to go, how to execute the order, and which property to seize. We don't want to be in the position of using any discretion in these civil issues. Section 2, with regards to garnishment, currently a responsive garnishee goes to several parties in the matter. This just would clarify as to when the time frames start running, and we're asking that would be when the response hits the public record. In other words, when the garnishee's response is filed with the clerk of the court. The last that I'm going to address deals with the service of protective orders in a neighboring county. I've been a deputy for 15 years and have chased respondents in restraining orders throughout my career. And there have been many times where I've been prevented from crossing the county line when I have a lead on a respondent who's been ducking me. And unfortunately, it's just across the county line, and I have to stop what I'm doing, advise the petitioner that I'm mailing the documents to the next sheriff, and asking the next sheriff to pick up the ball. That creates sometimes a critical time lag in which a person is not protected by a restraining order, and we've all read or heard testimony before of people who have suffered or died when restraining orders haven't been served and they've not been protected by the protection that the courts are trying to afford them. I'm going to turn it over, and I'll be happy to answer any questions and ask Deputy Wallace to address some of the other issues of this bill.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Brian Wallace. I'm the civil deputy with the Polk County Sheriff's Office in Dallas, and I support House Bill 2821 that's introduced before you for several reasons under each section, and I'm feeling a little under the weather myself today, and I'm going to try not to repeat what Deputy Ross said. Under sections 1 through 4 of the bill addressing forcing entry, we believe that this is necessary because as of right now, as Deputy Ross was mentioning, Chapter 18, it was redone that deleted Chapter 29 unintentionally, does not give us the authority currently to force entry, not without infringing on people's Fourth Amendment rights. As Deputy Ross was saying, we're ministerial officers and we do not pick and choose what we do. We follow the direction of the court. As it is right now, what we have to do without this verbiage is keep going back to the residents. If we know that property is in a building or enclosure, we cannot publicly demand entry into that or force entry, which causes the property to be secreted or moved to an adjacent county or another location. So this would just help carry out the court's orders. And my argument is how efficient and serious are our courts without the sheriff being able to carry out the court's orders. Consequently, we're the only agency that does that, the sheriff. Under Section 2 through 4, there's no need for intense discussion. This just clarifies time frames when the clock starts to tick on when the sheriff is directed to sell property under garnishment. It establishes just clear time frames. And as Deputy, again, as Deputy Ross was saying, that starts when the clerk of the court receives the garnishee response form. So that just merely provides a clear understanding for the sheriff and the plaintiff and all involved. I'm going to address more specifically sections 5 through 8, sheriff's fees. We initially asked for a $5 increase.
Can I hold on for just a second? On that point, we had a garnishment bill that rectified some of the problems from the 2001 session that's already gone through here. So I'm going to have counsel take a look and make sure we don't have conflict amendments here and that we don't have different agreements going different directions. So if you made deals in the House, let us know what you did on fees, et cetera, et cetera. And then the conflict amendments, we want to get to the committee before you.
Mr. Chair, I think that the bill you're talking about is House Bill 2646, and we were involved with that one as well. And they chose not to... that's another Oregon Law Commission. They chose not to address our issues because on the House side they were going to address our issues within 2821.
Right.
So the same legislative counsel, David Hendricks, worked on both of them. So I think that we're okay.
Right. I'm going to make sure we are.
Sure.
You don't mind. Okay. You have some additional things you wanted to say?
Yes.
Sorry for cutting you off.
No, that's okay. That's quite all right. Under Sections 5 through 8, Sheriff's Fees, we initially asked for a $5 increase. And now we're looking at just a minimal $3 increase. There has not been an increase in civil fees since 1997. And quite frankly, I'll just break it down for you. Numerous papers that the sheriff serves are free of service. Everything from stalking orders to restraining orders to criminal subpoenas, support enforcement papers, the list goes on. That in itself causes the sheriff to subsidize other papers, which is not fair to the general public because their money basically should not be used for private enterprise. Those costs include processing the paperwork, gas and vehicle expenses, travel time, because sometimes it takes several attempts before service is affected, the return of service and the postage associated with that, and the deputy's time. That's all that I'm going to say under that section. And then finally, sections 9 through 16, allowing a sheriff to make service of a restraining order in an adjacent county. Currently, sheriffs may or may not do that. We just want direction from the legislature and law, just allowing the sheriff to just go to a neighboring county if the respondent... if it is found that the respondent is just across the river or across the county lines, whatnot, rather than, as Mr. Lovett was saying, mail the restraining order to that adjacent county, which could take 4 days before it's received and processed, and then the service is attempted. So that just clarifies that. I'd be happy to answer any questions that you have now or after Deputy Leader adds his 2 cents.
Where do we have the Deputy Leader talk to us?
Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Tim Leader. I'm the Civil Deputy Supervisor for the Washington County Sheriff's Office. And I'm here today to offer my testimony in support of House Bill 2821 before you today. Coming at the end of the line here, I think most of what I would have to say would reiterate what each of my colleagues have said to you here today. The only additional... But I would like to say for the record that I 100% concur and support all the comments they have made regarding this House bill. The only additional comments I thought I might add is in relation to sections 5 through 8 on the sheriff's fees. I think the proposed fee increase here is a very modest one and is just would help us to defray some of our ever-rising costs. You know, our salary, our benefits, our medical costs, et cetera, constantly on the rise, as our vehicle costs and gas to perform this mandated function. Speaking strictly from Washington County Sheriff's Office point of view, just to give you an idea of the relationship between our operating costs on an annual basis and our civil fees that we bring in, last fiscal year, The civil fees that we brought in represented approximately in the neighborhood of 15% to 18% of what our annual operating costs are to perform this function. So we're not even close to knocking on the door of a halfway point here. This is just to help us defray some of those rising costs. And I think the other piece to that here is the language that's being proposed clarifies the current language, which is a little ambiguous and is handled in different ways at different counties throughout the state. So this proposed language would put all 36 county sheriffs on an even plane, and so we would be charging the same fees to attorneys and their and plaintiffs throughout the state.
Okay, I've got a question in section one where it talks about the sheriff and shall use. It says shall use such force as is necessary to enter into a building or enclosure and take the property into possession. I see that you're an armed deputy. My concern would be the word shall, and what I perceived in my field that from time to time officers do not make good judgment. They make mistakes. They advance or accelerate or escalate a situation to the point where you're involved in deadly physical force going after, in this case, a piece of property. So I want to hear some response to that issue.
Chairman Minnis, if I could respond to that. You're exactly correct, and that's why we wish shall to remain, is so that the deputy is not making the decision. We are executing a court order. We're not deciding if on this case we're going to do it or this case we're not going to do it. We have a court order that directs us to do it. In a civil action, the sheriff is not a party to it. We truly don't seek to go into somebody's residence. We are directed by the court to execute it. We want to be completely ministerial in it, have the court tell us where to go, how to do it, and what to get. We don't want to be using discretion.
That raises some interesting questions. Court issues an order. It doesn't absolve you as an officer of responsibility to use due care and caution in entering a building. Just because the statute says you shall doesn't mean you make a bad judgment call and kick in a door or use whatever force is necessary and engage someone that you would otherwise not need to engage.
And Mr. Chair, I think that's exactly why the words "as is necessary" appear on line 11 in the old statute and in the proposed new statute.
Well, I guess what I want to do is make sure that the record is clear that we're not and would not be authorizing officers to exercise largesse and appropriation of this authority. And I gotta tell you this, I've done quite a few officer-involved shooting investigations myself. I've seen some good decisions. I've seen some legally justifiable decisions that were not necessarily wise decisions. So it's important that there is an exercise of restraint. Training needs to be part and parcel of what goes on here. I guess I wouldn't want to be, as a detective, my agency investigating shooting where it's justifiable under the law, but probably one of the worst decisions that an officer can make, because every officer I've ever dealt with who's had to engage in that kind of response to a situation has been traumatically impacted by the exercise of their authority. So that does concern me a little bit.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Bree.
I'm glad you brought that up, because as I read this too, I visualize situations where someone might be very hostile but unarmed and just say, you're going to have to shoot me to get this property. And the way I read this, then if that's what's necessary, and I know that wouldn't stand up, but I guess I would feel more comfortable with some qualifying language for that particular phrase. It does seem to be pretty broad.
I don't know if we can go back and tie it back in with the use of force statutes and the criminal statutes or not, or if that makes any sense at all. But there has to, I think, be some onus on the officer to make a good judgment.
Chairman, if I can offer this, all the civil statutes that we have, almost all of them are fleshed out in extensive case law and utilize language that's historical. And all of that case law develops standards of conduct for which we all have to live with and are trained by. So while I hear the issue you're raising, and it's exactly the issue that a couple of folks discussed on the House side, we would be very uncomfortable finding an other language to use, because I think we would lose that case law unless we were very careful about how we
do
get
you
it.
Do you have a summary of the case law, the seminal cases that you're talking about?
Chair Minnis, I do, but it's a sheriff's civil manual, and it's quite extensive. Maybe I could provide something to counsel.
Well, how many cases are there that give guidance to this, the seminal cases? I don't want every case. But
yeah, I would have to look back. I didn't bring my manual with me.
Why don't we do a little research on this, counsel?
All right, thank you, Chairman. Mr. Buffett, you're saying there's case law, so you're saying this language comes from another statute because it's new language. So how would a court interpret this language if it's a new statute unless it came from another statute?
Actually, counsel, this language is the statute that was inadvertently repealed out of Chapter 29 in the 2001 legislation, a statutory language that had been in place for as long as I could trace back the legislative history. And so this was repealed for the first time, we believe accidentally, in 2001, because when they repealed the entirety of Chapter 29 as part of that omnibus garnishment bill.
Okay. Chairman of the Committee, one further question. Mr. Bivet, would you have problems if we put after such and before force reasonable? So, say, use such reasonable force as is necessary?
Counsel, I don't think we'd have a problem with that word.
Okay.
And maybe that would satisfy the concern, or at least put a standard in there. I think the case law would require it anyways.
And Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Senator Briggs.
Would you also, you know, I would like to at least consider providing some kind of out for a sheriff's deputy who gets into a situation that is just the most reasonable thing they could do is just leave. I mean, you're talking about one deputy there. If they're mandated to use such force as is necessary or such reasonable force, when the sensible thing might be to simply leave the situation.
Can you respond?
Yeah. Senator Burdick, Mr. Chairman, to cite an example, we recently had one of these where we had explicit court order to go in and seize rental property from one of these rental furniture companies. Two deputies went to the residence. They were met by a lady with an extremely thick security door. She denied them entry. She displayed symptoms close to that of somebody who's mentally ill. The deputies contacted me, and I instructed them to back off. We started I called the lady on the phone, started negotiations with her. That didn't get us anywhere. We ended up going with a very large entry team and informing her after going through the court order where I handed it to her. I asked her to read it with me. We went through it step by step, and I informed her we were going to take off your door and we are coming in. From an officer safety standpoint, this language, I don't believe, orders us to do it at that exact time when we're knocking on a door and we discover that we're not going to win the situation. Sheriffs are going to do it in a safe and prudent manner, and in the case I cited you, we backed off, tried to learn about what we were going up against, assembled a team sufficient to safely execute the court's order, went back, and we did safely execute the court order, but we did back off initially.
So if I understand correctly, you get paid $28 for doing that?
Actually, for executing a court order, we get paid $47. We used 11 deputies.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, okay, great. Thank you. Anybody else wishing to testify? House Bill 2821. No one willing to testify here. All right, close the public hearing. We're adjourned.